everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace.
And I'm Manny.
And in this episode, we're going to be talking about a couple of books that come out on October 5th from Top Cow. And we're also going to be talking about some DC Rebirth books for October 5th, as well as a couple of their miniseries that are rolling out. But before we get to the books this week...
We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
I'm sure we're going to have a lot more news for you coming up later in the week with New York Comic Con set to start this weekend, but just a couple items of news that caught my attention this week that I wanted to mention. First off, we finally have some news about the Justice League of America title that's going to launch in February now as part of DC's second wave of Rebirth titles. You know, this was announced at the same panel slash press conference at WonderCon at the LA Convention Center as all the rest of the titles, but we didn't have many details, much like the Super Sons title. And with the success of DC Rebirth, DC just felt that some of the other titles that were announced that they, you know, hadn't necessarily settled on things, and they could take their time. You know, there's no reason to rush it. And so there hasn't been much news or movement. Well, just this week it was announced that Yvonne Reis is going to be the artist of the Justice League title, and it's going to be written by Steve Orlando, and it's going to spin out of the upcoming Justice League versus Suicide Squad event. So I imagine Yvonne Reis isn't going to be the only artist, because it's going to be another one of the twice monthly books. So let me just read from the press release. In January 2017, kicking off Justice League of America, hitting shelves twice a month, starting February 2017, are four DC Rebirth one-shots. They'll make four bold statements that form the foundation of a team that will bring justice to places that have given up on hope, places that thought heroism would never find them. The Justice League of America goes there. They explore the microverse, the hidden cities, the worlds within worlds. They go to the other side of the map and explode forward with the new face of heroism. This is a Justice League that looks like America, that proves heroism can look like anything and anyone. From February 1960 to February 2017, the mission hasn't changed, it's just evolved. So the one-shots are, the first one is Vixen, written by Steve Orlando and Jody Hauser, with art by Jamal Campbell. The second book is Ryan Choi Adam, who we last saw in the DC Rebirth special. That one is also going to be written by Steve Orlando with a yet-to-be-named artist. The third book is The Ray. Steve Orlando writing that one with Stephen Byrne on art. And it says one of the first gay Justice Leaguers. And the fourth is Killer Frost, who has always been a villain in the DC Universe until now. I think maybe in the DC Futures End Weekly series, she kind of played an anti-hero. She seemed like she was turning over a new leaf. I imagine a lot of that has to do with her appearances on the Flash TV show and them wanting to take her away from being an out-and-out villain. So that one is by Steve Orlando and Jody Hauser with Mirko Andolfo. So I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with Mirko Andolfo. I'm not sure if he's or she's the artist or what. So those are the four one-shots that are going to lead into Justice League of America. I imagine there will be more heroes on the team than just those four. It does say a black member, an Asian member, a gay member, and a blue redemptive member so far. So that's the Justice League. Yvonne, they have the covers. If you Google Yvonne Reis Justice League, you'll probably find the covers by Yvonne Reis. They look great. I'm pretty interested in this. They aren't all characters that I really enjoy. I like Vixen. Ryan Choi Adam, I actually don't have much experience with. The Ray, again, I've never read any of the Ray series. I don't think he was gay before, so not sure what's going on there. Killer Frost I've always liked, but I don't really know her as far as a hero, I guess you'd say. So one thing I will say is it seems like they're giving Steve Orlando a lot of work. He's currently writing Supergirl. He's kind of the showrunner for this Batman event that's going on right now, which is the, we're going to talk about in a little bit, the Night of the Monster Men. Plus, he has the Midnighter Apollo series that's coming out. So, I mean, I imagine some of these, maybe they're done. You know, he may be, he's probably at this point completely done working on Night of the Monster Men. He's probably completely done working on the Midnighter and Apollo series. So I imagine this is probably taking up a lot of his time, although he's got to probably still be working on the Justice League versus Suicide Squad, I would think. Wouldn't think he's done with that yet. So I don't want to say they're pegging Steve Orlando as their go-to guy for writing like diverse titles, you know, just because the guy's gay. But he's certainly a passionate creator every time I've talked to him. I guess it remains to be seen just how good it'll be. But it looks like they're at least trying to pull out some of the lesser-known characters, so that's always a good thing. Now, the next bit of news I want to talk about is Warren Ellis has been tapped to oversee a Wildstorm reboot and write the Wildstorm comic. That's three words. So apparently he's going to completely reinvigorate the Wildstorm comics. This is the second time he's going to be doing that. He had, of course, his famous run on Stormwatch and then The Authority with Brian Hitch. And pretty much every Wildstorm title eventually tied into that. So he's going to be working with John Davis Hunt, who does the art on the Clean Room series with Gail Simone, and his art is really spectacular. So he's going to create the new the Wildstorm monthly comic starting in February. It's going to reboot the Wildstorm universe, and then he'll oversee a new series, Michael Cray, Wildcats, Zealot, and other titles they haven't mentioned yet. And he had this to say about it. After long reflection, I couldn't turn down the invitation to renovate the house that Jim Lee built and refit its unique combination of cosmic paranoia and paramilitary conspiracy for the post-political space madness of the 20-teens. I'm looking forward to it. So, Warren Ellis has some pretty crazy ideas. You know, his stuff's really out there. So, a lot of old-school Wildstorm fans have been kind of clamoring for a return of the Wildstorm universe, you know, with the DC launched their new 52 storyline. There was a few titles that's, you know, they had a Stormwatch title, they had a Voodoo title, they had a Grifter title, and they just didn't seem to work. I don't know if, you know, for whatever reason, they just couldn't seem to find what was going to work. So with this kind of relaunch, it'll be interesting to see if they're going to choose to have it tie in closely with the DC universe, or if it's going to be a separate corner, or what exactly they're going to do. But, you know, Warren Ellis certainly has his, you know, fans, and he's a good writer, so I'll be interested to see where it goes from here. All right, the next bit of news kind of ties into our first comic we're going to talk about, and that's Eclipse. It's been announced by Image Comics and Top Cow that Eclipse is going to warrant a continuing series. This doesn't come as a huge surprise, considering the success of the first issue and the passion of the creators on the book. I think it was originally planned as a 6-issue miniseries, but now it's planned on going for as long as the sales dictate, I suppose. You know, when I talked to Zach Kaplan and Chris Northrup at Long Beach Comic Con, Zach specifically said that, you know, he wasn't necessarily thinking in those terms. He was just, you know, focusing issue by issue, but that he did hope that the story and the sales warranted the continuation to go for a longer amount of time, because he did have a lot more stories, a lot more things that he wanted to explore in the world of Eclipse. So that's some pretty good news.
Please do note, this is no ordinary comic book. It is in permanent condition. If you spill soda on it, the drops fly off harmlessly onto lesser comics.
Oh.
Yes, you are quite correct to gasp.
All right, so the first book we're going to talk about is Eclipse number 2. The writer is Zach Kaplan. The art is by Giovanni Timpano, and the colors are by Chris Northrup. So what do you think, Manny, of issue 2?
Issue 2, I thought it was going to have a little bit more development into it, but it was just a little bit more mystery on who the who's this person who can survive out in the sun. Although we did find out a little bit about what he probably did before the event, but I kind of like that we're still kind of shrouded in mystery. And again, very clever use of of their surroundings, especially when they're kind of baited into a certain area that has an entire roof made out of glass, and whoever this person is uses it for his advantage. So it's a good book, and they're doing a really good job at keeping it really interesting and keeping you hooked for the next one. So I'm very much looking forward to the next book. The art is a little different, but it's definitely fits the book. Kind of like not as much as I dislike the clone artwork as first, but it's kind of in that same area for me. But you know, the story is so good that for me it's very, very forgiving.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this second issue. I don't know that I expected more story development. I kind of felt like it hit the sweet spot. We learned a little bit more about kind of the world that they're living in. You know, we learned that the subways still run. We learned there's houses underground. There still seems to be the have and have-nots that we see, you know, in the world today. We got a little more background on David Baxter, who's kind of the main character. Yeah, we saw really, really, really cool Sunkill. It didn't necessarily surprise me the way the first issue did with the mirror Sunkill, which was, you know, a really holy crap moment. But this one was sure cool. I didn't see it coming, but it didn't have the same impact. Probably because of the fact that the way the Sunkill goes down, like even if you'd done that without the sun, that it would have been, you know, dangerous to the people. So it wasn't, you know, whereas the first one was like, whoa, a mirror, that's crazy. But yeah, the final page too, wow, man, that is just a brutal scene. that image is like burned into my brain. So yeah, very good second issue. I was very pleased to hear from Zach. I actually heard from him last week that the book had been picked up to be an ongoing. So congratulations to him and Giovanni and Chris. It's well-deserved, and I hope you all are picking up this book. I think that the second printing actually comes out on the 12th, the second printing of issue 1. But issue 2 does come out tomorrow. So even if you haven't read issue 1 and you're planning on picking it up, make sure you get to the comic shop tomorrow, pick up issue 2. You don't want to miss out, because I have a feeling that issue 2 will probably sell out as well. It won't be until issue 3 that the retailers will have had a chance to up their orders, realizing the success of issue 1, just because of the nature of having to order 2 months in advance. So, yeah, Eclipse issue 2 picks up right where issue 1 left off quality-wise. Really great book. Get out there and pick it up. All right, next up we have Romulus number 1. Written by Brian Hill, and the art is by Nelson Blake II. There always seem to be in comics some books that are kind of conspiracy theory, you know, some secret ruling people that are manipulating, pulling the strings, you know, pulling the wool over the eyes of us regular folk, and just controlling the path the world is taking and the direction of mankind. And this is another book along those lines. I feel like I've read a lot of these kind of stories lately, or maybe it's just the current presidential election campaign that's been taking over my Facebook feed and my Twitter feed, and people constantly spouting garbage about, oh, Donald Trump this or Hillary that, you know, we're breaking the news and blah. I'm so tired of conspiracy theories and just headlines that are nothing but clickbait, and 99% of them are just out and out lies. And so I think maybe that's why I didn't enjoy this book as much as I would have otherwise, because at this point I'm kind of conspiracy theoried out. I'm just looking to kind of get away from all that. So it's an interesting premise. The art from Nelson Blake II is handled pretty well. The colors are maybe not, I don't know, they're pretty muted. I don't know that it does the art any favors. The backgrounds are very light as well. So in a way, I kind of felt like the book was a little bit light. It almost felt like a zero issue, like maybe a book that would be given away on Free Comic Book Day to kind of suck people into the regular story. Maybe a little more story, a little more development than a zero issue, but not much. So I can't really say whether or not I'm going to like it. Based on the strength of Postal and Brian Edward Hill's work there, I would think, oh yeah, I'm going to be in for sure. So I'll certainly check out the next issue. But as of now, I don't know. I guess I expect a little bit more. What were your thoughts, Manny?
Well, there's a lot to set up in this issue, especially with setting up the idea that this group has been pulling the strings on a lot of historical events throughout the years, and then all of a sudden we have to focus on present day, and we have to focus on what is her name?
Eshar?
Yes. And her mother, pretty much rebelling against the group or just trying not to get killed by them as the last two wolves. So I can kind of see where this one was kind of a little bit slow. But there's some moments that I really enjoyed. For example, the fact that she names her sword Axis so that she claims that way her mother's always the one that kills them. I thought that was pretty cool. So because of, like you were saying, the strength of the other titles that they've written, I'm definitely in. I think the thing that bugs me the most, and it bugs me this in a lot of other books too, is the lack of backgrounds in the panels. It makes it, to me, kind of almost look incomplete. For example, the pages where we first see the Dr. Franklin, like those backgrounds are really lacking anything, and it, for whatever reason, it bugs me a lot. But I think we've got to give it one or two more issues, and I'm sure it's going to develop well, but only time will tell.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason that I felt like there wasn't as much there, it is part of, you know, like you're saying, the lack of backgrounds, plus the way it starts out. I mean, there's a lot of panels where it's like one word and an image, and it made just for a very quick read, and I don't know, it just, like I said, it felt very much like a zero issue. So I'll be in for one more, but I have a pretty short leash these days on titles, just because the budget is pretty much stretched to the max at this point. All right, the first DC book we're going to talk about is Aquaman number 8. The writer is Dan Abnett. We have Scott Eaton on pencils for this particular issue. The inks are by Wayne Fokker, and the colorist is Gabe Eltab. So we saw at the end of 7 this giant creature having been raised from the depths of the ocean by Black Manta and his Nemo squad. And we learn in this issue who exactly that is. But basically, the issue is one big fight. And we learn that Atlantis isn't necessarily the target of this giant monster. And I wasn't actually familiar with who it was, like once we learned the identity. So I had to go and do a little research. And then when I found out who it was, I was like, oh man, I don't know how Aquaman's gonna stop this one. So, a solid issue. Certainly not the strongest of the run so far. Not much happens in the issue as far as the political side of things. And I feel like that's kind of the strength of this book, or has been the strength of this book so far. And, you know, I've said multiple times, I really prefer when we get the Brad Walker issues as far as the art goes. Eaton does a serviceable job. The fight scenes are handled really well. He does a good job of the layouts within the panels, because there's a lot of characters, and you know, the battle scenes are always a challenge to try to fit everything in and make it look crowded and such. So not look crowded, rather. So a solid issue. But in the end, nothing that really stood out to me. Your thoughts, Manny?
Yeah, I would agree with you. It's a solid issue. For me, though, I found it more... The most interesting part of the issue was Mira's going to the Tower of the Widowhood.
Oh, right.
And how she's going to be going through a process so that she can marry Arthur Curry or Aquaman and be the legit queen of Atlantis. And so I found those panels to be a little bit more interesting than Aquaman going toe to toe with this big monster. And I'm not sure why, but that was my favorite part of the issue. Just wanting to see, especially after she hears the alarm sound, and now she's trying to leave, because I mean we both know that she's always by Aquaman's side to help him out in those situations, and usually is a really big help as they fight whatever foe is in front of them. But in this case, she has to actually use restraint and do what's right by Atlantis and get this done. And I find that really interesting.
I found that to be extremely annoying, actually. Here's these priestesses that are, you know, clearly there's got to be a ton of commotion and noise and the alarm's going off or whatever, and they're worried about teaching her some poetry and crap about, you know, the ancient history of Atlantis. Who cares? Atlantis is not going to exist if this is a giant emergency. You would think at the very least these priestesses would send another one of their members out to find out what's going on and how serious it is. They know how powerful Mira is. They know what great help she could be to Aquaman. And if it's really something that's a legitimate emergency, danger, catastrophe, disaster, you know, Lord knows Atlantis has had enough of them over the years. Maybe that's it. Maybe that, you know, they've had so many disasters and they've always survived. The widows just believe that that they're going to survive again. But wouldn't you at least send a member of your, you know, coven or whatever you want to call it out to find out what's going on and see if Mira's help is needed, rather than just blithely saying, "No, you got to stay here. You know, you got to learn about the ancient history of Atlantis." I mean, if Atlantis is going to be destroyed, what difference does it make? If Aquaman's going to be killed, what difference does it make that you're worthy to marry him? So that just bugged me, and I don't know if it just seemed like a cliche to me too, because at the end of the day, she probably is going to choose to go and help Aquaman and probably be the one that saves the day, and then, you know, the citizenry of Atlantis will love her because she actually was the one that saved the day and saved the king. I could easily see that going down, where, you know, if she just went now to help him, it probably wouldn't get to that point. But that's just me nitpicking. So, like I said, solid issue. Great cover, too, by the way, by Brad Walker. Next up, we have Batman number 8. This is part 4, is it? Or part...
No, I think we need to start with Nightwing, right?
Is Nightwing first? No, I think Batman's first.
Oh, no, you're right.
Yeah, it's part 4. Batman's part 4 of Night of the Monster Men. So this is the event that's being headlined or all planned out, plotted, whatever you want to say, by Steve Orlando. He's joined on the writing for this issue by the regular Batman writer Tom King. The art is by Riley Rosmo, and the colors are by Ivan Placencia. So what were your thoughts on Batman number 8?
Like we talked about last week, about kind of just getting through this event, and that's kind of how I feel. I just really want to get through it all. And I know, I understand that we're reading fictional stories, and, you know, there's no such thing as Batman and or superheroes or things like that. But the way that Nightwing and Gotham Girl are transformed into these monsters, for me, is stretching it a little bit that they can ever go back to being normal. They're very, very grotesque looking, and they do a good job with that, but at that point, they really lost me there with the idea that that everything was going to be okay, and so that to me was kind of threw me off a little bit. But I really liked the teamwork between Spoiler and Orphan. I thought that was done really, really well when they saved everybody in the cave. But like I said, kind of over this already, and just want to move on to Batman and Bane. Although I will say that another really cool thing that I liked about the issue was Batman's new Bane suit. I mean, not Bane, Clayface suit. That was really cool. Out of all the things he could have thought up, that I never thought that he would use a Clayface as a suit, and that worked really well.
Yeah, I agree with you. Those couple things stood out. I thought once Gotham Girl and Nightwing were transformed into monsters, that the focus of the series of the crossover was going to kind of shift over to finding a cure for them, and it would take the rest of the crossover, and it would be a really hard thing. Not like they get transformed into monsters in the very next issue. Well, we figured out how to save them. So yeah, it didn't necessarily sit that well with me either. I guess I didn't think about it in terms of how grotesque and transformed they were, how quickly that happened, and then how quickly it went back. Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, yeah, like you said, it is a comic book. It is fantasy, fiction, science fiction, whatever. But yeah, that's really stretching it. As far as the art goes, it has a very washed out look. I guess it makes sense, that it's raining during the whole issue and whatnot. Riley Rossmo is a great choice as far as drawing the monsters. They all look grotesque and, sufficiently weird. So that works for me there. His panel layouts, I don't particularly care for. They're a little jumbled. Things get a little confusing at times, especially being that it's more of a watercolor, a washed out look. So that doesn't necessarily work for me there. Yeah, he seems to be at his best when he's drawing the monsters. But I will completely agree with you that the Batman wearing Clayface as a kind of a suit of armor was really, really cool. And I'll further agree with you that, yeah, I can't wait for this to be over. I really want to get to the Batman I Am Suicide storyline and get back to Tom King kicking butt writing Batman. I'm pretty much over this event already myself. All right, next up we have Cyborg number 2. This is written by John Semper, pencils by Paul Pelletier, inks by Tony Cordos and Tom Palmer, and colors by Guy Major. So we saw at the end of issue 1, Kilgore made his appearance, and this whole entire issue is pretty much Cyborg fighting against Kilgore. But in a way, the fight is kind of secondary. It's kind of in the background, in as much as Kilgore is challenging Cyborg, not just physically, they're fighting each other physically, but as they're fighting, Kilgore is challenging who Cyborg is and why he does what he does. Kilgore is challenging the fact that, are you really a machine? Are you a man? My boss, the person that sent me, thinks that you're more machine than man, that you need to pretty much abandon any humanity or any remnants of your human side, because the machines are where it's at. The machines that have been discarded by humans, used and thrown away for years and years, and it's now time for us to rise up and take over and exterminate humankind. So again, continuing the theme that John Semper has been kind of exploring since the book started, which is the man versus machine part of Cyborg, who is Victor Stone. And it's a pretty interesting story. I'm still enjoying it very much. There's a little twist at the end that felt a little cliched. I could have done without that. I think it's hard at times for Semper to tell the story he wants to tell without falling into some of these cliches. I mean, it's kind of like when people say, oh, don't make judgments about others. Don't make assumptions. Don't fall into these cliches. But I mean, the thing is, they exist for a reason. You know what I mean? Like, stereotypes exist for a reason, because, there's like always a grain of truth behind it. There's a reason that stereotype came into existence. And so much in the same way, there's a reason these cliches are used, because they're often effective in advancing the story, and certain situations, putting the protagonist in certain situations you know, does show you something about who that character is. It's not always easy to come up with, you know, new ideas and things that haven't been done before. So even though the end was a bit, little bit of a cliche, I hope that Semper finds a way to put his own twist on it going forward. But I'm still in on Cyborg for sure. I mean, this is a really enjoyable book. The art, Paul Pelletier is killing it on art. He manages to make it feel very consistent with who Cyborg is as a character. And by that, I mean the panels, the construction of the panels themselves. It's very machine-like. It's very techno. There's a part in the middle of the book where Kilgore is kind of explaining to his theory to Cyborg about how, you know, humankind has used machines and thrown them away for decades, and it's time for the machines to take over. And kind of, I mean, the panels that Pelletier constructs are awesome. But what's even more cool than that is the fact that kind of in the background to the side of the panels, you see like Cyborg's face, but just the techno part of it, not the human part. And you see, as Kilgore is talking and explaining what he wants to happen, you can see more and more of the machine taking over Cyborg's face, kind of like a glimpse into the future. Like, if Cyborg were to join and give up his human parts, like, this is how it, you know, the technology that's a part of him would continue to grow and you know, become more prominent and take over. And it's just really, really cool. So kudos to Pelletier on the art. This is probably the strongest issue art-wise so far for me. And yeah, Cyborg continues to be an incredibly good book. Very, very, very well done. And also, I'll mention that, I don't know that I've mentioned this before, Semper's dialogue is very, very good. It's it doesn't get preachy, it doesn't get comic booky, but it he does a great job of, you get a sense of who each of the characters are through his dialogue without even realizing it. You get some depth just based on the way people say things. And it's a book that's not necessarily a quick read. I wouldn't say that Semper is wordy, but you do get a lot of dialogue, and it just makes for a richer story, in my opinion. Another great book, another great issue by Semper, Pelletier, Cordos Palmer, and Major. What do you think of issue two, Manny? I know you haven't liked Cyborg as much as I have so far.
Issue two was amazing. I really liked the dialogue. I love the panel layouts, and overall, I think it was done so well. Part of what I really liked about Kilgore and his reasoning with Cyborg, just the way he ups the level as the issue goes on. He just kind of starts really, really easily trying to just persuade him to join. And then he goes on and lists the reason why, as a machine, why he should join. And then he starts adding more and more layers to it. So he starts adding slavery touching on the fact that he's an African American. And then when that doesn't work, then he brings up his dad and the things that he said about him, maybe creating a Frankenstein monster and not being part human. And he goes on and on. And then once that doesn't work, he actually uses his literal dad as bait and says, well, if you want to save him, you're gonna have to sacrifice yourself. And so I thought that was really smart the way they did it. Just the way it's written out, it's done so well. You're right. This particular issue does take a little bit longer to read than other books, but Kilgore's argument is fairly valid if you think about it. I mean, if Kilgore and whoever he's working for are machines, and they are an AI that has reached a point where they're self-aware, doesn't that mean anything? Wouldn't you see yourself as a slave? My favorite lines are when he actually isn't even talking to him anymore. He's just kind of transmitting ideas. And these are the panels that you're talking about where you just see kind of his machine side of his face. I think, for example, is it not mankind's way to do nothing but seek to enslave or destroy? Can we not draw a direct parallel between the enslavement of machines and the slavery that men and women of your own human ethnicity once suffered a mere century and a half ago? So he touches on a lot of very good points about humans and about the disasters they've caused throughout the years. But Vic Stone does a really good job at remembering his humanity, all the good that people do. There's the image of the jazz player as such, and other things. And it's just done so smart. That's what I'm going to call it. It's a really smart book. And it's almost not even a battle between Kilgore and Cyborg, but I mean, this is something that Cyborg was dealing with himself even before somebody was beating him down. So it's a very, very good issue. And I agree with you that the ending, it didn't need to be so cliche. They could have maybe thought of, to do it a different way. But we'll see where they take it in issue number 3.
Yeah, it's exactly what I said. It's not. I mean, it's almost like their physical battle is secondary to their battle of ideologies. And one thing that you talked about that I didn't mention, maybe because I didn't notice, but now that you talk about it, it's so obvious, and it's been a hallmark of the book in issue 2, issue 1, in the one shot, and I don't know if it comes from Semper's innate storytelling sensibility or the fact that he comes from animation, where this is very important in animation, where you have to be very aware of timing and how long things last. The books are incredibly well paced. Sometimes pacing in comics can be tricky. You know, you ramp up too soon and then it can drag in the middle. There's a letdown, and it's important when you're telling long form stories that you get the beats right. And some issues can seem to drag a little just because it's between, big events in the story. Walking Dead's a perfect example of where that happens. That's long been a complaint about the comic. But this issue in particular, the pacing is done so well as the fight ramps up in intensity. Like you said, Kilgore starts throwing out, more and more valid points about why things are the way they are and why he and the person he's working for are doing what they're doing. And as the fight goes on and becomes more critical, and we see Vic's father as a hostage, as all that tension and drama is built up, the challenge to Vic Stone's ideas, that ramps up as well, and it's just done incredibly, incredibly well. So kudos to John Semper, Paul Pelletier, and the rest of the guys on a great issue. All right, next up we have Dead Man and the Mansion of Forbidden Love, number 1. This is written by Sarah Vaughn, pencils by Lan Medina, and colors by Juan Villarubia. I'm going to talk about the art first. This is a beautiful book to look at. I mean, beautiful. Especially the detail. The background, we were talking about in Romulus, how the background is lacking. This book, the backgrounds are lush. They're detailed. It takes place in this old mansion, and everything looks realistic and, like I said, detailed and gorgeous and fully realized. If there's anything about the art that I didn't care for, is that at times, particularly the main female character in the book, Bernice, she just looks a little stiff at times. And it's only her. It doesn't occur with Dead Man or the other characters in the book, Sam, what's the other? Nathan? Is that the other guy's name? I think so.
Yeah.
So it's a good story so far. It's a long story. I think it's like a prestige format. I think that it's supposed to be 4 or 6 issues. But like I said, oversized. as far as page count. So I'm definitely in. It very much is in line with what a Dead Man book should be, which is kind of creepy, kind of mysterious, dealing with ghosts and the supernatural. I've always been somewhat of a Dead Man fan, but I, that being said, I haven't read a lot of books within. I like the idea of him, but I haven't read that much stuff that he's been in. And it's something he's one of those characters that I want to know more about. I just haven't gotten around to learning more about him. So I'm not sure how many pages it is. My digital copy says there's 50 pages, but you know that of course includes the front cover. It is $5.95, but it looks like it's painted basically. But yeah, the art, like I said, the backgrounds especially are absolutely amazing. Medina does a great job of just making it look like a fully realized world. And Via Rubio, the colors, muted, dark, a lot of purples and grays and blacks, exactly what you'd expect from kind of a noir supernatural book. I would not call this a horror comic. It's not, you know, super scary, or it doesn't go for, you know, gore or shock or any of that. It's just creepy and spooky. And yeah, I actually was surprised by how much I enjoyed it. And as far as the characters go, there seems to be maybe the formation of some kind of a love triangle going on. And we see Dead Man kind of caught in this situation with things not working the way they usually work for him. So he's very much at a disadvantage as far as not understanding what's going on, much like the reader. So in a way, he's almost our point of view character, which is pretty interesting, because I think a lot of times in the Dead Man stories I've read, it's kind of been the other way around, with Dead Man possessing people, and the people he possesses, that's kind of our window into the story. And this time it's flipped around. So yeah, I enjoyed the first issue. I'll definitely be checking out issue two. What were your thoughts, Manny?
I really liked it. It was really mysterious, and it's just a good book to look at. Like you were saying, lots of detail. I like the colors. Some of the facial expressions were great. So not much to add from what you said, but yeah, Dead Man to me also is one of those characters that I would like to learn more about, but somehow he always gets lost, kind of like a ghost.
All right, up next we have Death of Hawkman number one, written by Mark Andraco, pencils by Aaron Lopresti, inks by Livesay, and colors by Blonde. What were your thoughts here?
Death of Hawkman or Adam Strange number one?
Fair enough.
I liked it, but it kind of threw me off because the title says Death of Hawkman, and I said, oh, well, featuring Adam Strange. I didn't notice that on the cover. But I was like, oh, cool, Adam Strange. And then it goes straight to Adam Strange. And then I was like, oh, more Adam Strange and more Adam Strange. And wait a minute, is this an Adam Strange story? But I liked it because Adam Strange is a cool character, and it's very interesting kind of to see his Earth self, and then after he gets called back. I mean, Jesus, we see him sitting down. We see him one panel driving a spaceship, another one where he's eating pizza, playing video games on his couch, and then and him hanging out at the DMV like we normal folk love to do. So I really liked it. I thought the artwork was done really well. The colors are really strong, I think. But I want to see where this goes. I want to see, obviously, where Hawkman comes into play. Once again, it looks like it's going to be another invasion by what's the name of the race?
Thanagarians.
So we'll see where it goes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that DC chose to change the title or go with this title, because originally when it was announced, and when I spoke with Mark Andreyko at San Diego Comic-Con, when I interviewed him for the podcast, at that time the series had been announced as Hawkman and Adam Strange Out of Time.
Oh.
And so, you know, with both heroes, you know, equal billing, it made sense that, you know, this would be a story about both of them. And then it was announced early in September that they were actually going to call it Death of Hawkman. So I don't know if maybe they felt like Death of Hawkman would drum up more interest or, you know, get more eyes on the series. I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know that that's even true, that if they thought that would work, because the fact that Hawkman's been killed so many times, I mean, he's a character that is killed and is reincarnated. So, I mean, in a way, characters' death in comics over the last 15, 20 years have ceased to have much impact because it's been done over and over and over, and they invariably come back. And now add on the fact that Hawkman himself is a character who is constantly reincarnated, and I feel like calling a series Death of Hawkman is, you know, might as well call it Just Another Day at the Office for Hawkman. So I don't know if I agree with the changing of the title. I guess maybe after the story's over and we see what goes down, maybe it'll make more sense. But certainly this was, in a way, much of a setup issue. When I talked with Mark Andreyko, and I urge you all to go back and listen to that interview I did with him, he gives some insight into where he's coming from as far as these two characters. So yeah, it's kind of like a day in the life, in a way. Adam Strange is trying to find out why he's stuck on Earth, why the Zeta Beam is not showing up where it's supposed to take him back to Thanagar, or Ran, rather. And when he finally is sent back, when he finally does catch the beam back, he finds that Ran is in ruins. And that's basically kind of where the story is going to kick off. So it's very intriguing. The art, like you said, Manny, is really good. The colors, a bit of a primary palette from Blonde, but it suits the feel of kind of a, you know, lighthearted adventure action comic. And I have a feeling that's kind of what this is meant to be. It's certainly how I felt about it. I do find it interesting that it's being edited by David Wall, who is probably most known for creating the character of Witchblade, so didn't know he was doing work with DC. But yeah, Lopresti's pencils, you know, I always love Lopresti's art, very clean lines, very much kind of in that house style of DC, very classic superheroic. Love the way he draws Adam Strange's costume, I love the way he draws Hawkman's costume, and yeah, I can't wait to see why the Thanagarians have attacked, and, you know, where the story goes from here. It looks like Andreyko has a very much a good handle on who these characters are. So being that the first issue focused a lot on Adam Strange and where he was coming into the beginning of the story, I have a feeling that issue two is going to do the same for Hawkman. And being that he's more of a gruff character, I'm interested to see Andreyko's take on him. So yeah, the first issue was really good. As soon as I heard about this miniseries, I was pretty excited, because I always get kind of excited for stories that focus on some of the lesser-known characters in the DC universe. And so far, the first issue really lived up to my expectations. So, looking forward to issue two. Next up, we have Green Arrow number 8, written by Benjamin Percy, art by Otto Schmidt. Continues to be the best DC Rebirth that DC's putting out. We saw that at the end of, I guess it would have been issue 5, because issue 6 and 7 were kind of an interlude talking about Emiko and Shadow. And now we've gone back to catching up with all of what Oliver, Black Canary, and Diggle are up to. And they're pretty much stranded on an island. And there seem to be mysterious events going on that we don't exactly understand. But there's not a lot of forward progress in the story, but there's tons of character development, especially between Oliver and Black Canary, and I feel like it really sets up where they are going to be and the nature of their relationship going forward. There's a really great scene where Oliver is kind of, he's drawing in the sand, he's writing in the sand like a list of things. Okay, you know, when I get off the island, here's the things I want to do. And, you know, the first one he has on there is he wants to kill Broderick, which is the guy that, you know, was running his company that betrayed him to the Ninth Circle. And Canary comes over, asks what he's doing. He explains it to her, and she says, well, I think first you should put up on the list, let's get the hell off this island. And then she crosses out the kill Broderick and says, hey, that's not what we do. We're heroes. And so I feel like their relationship was always kind of a classic relationship in the pre-Flashpoint DC universe, and they chose to erase it in the New 52. And it's not like it didn't have the same impact. You didn't hear a lot of people complaining about it the way that, let's say, erasing Lois and Clark's marriage, Superman and Lois Lane's marriage, had. That was much more of a visible thing, much more of a mainstream thing. A lot of people commented on it. But I think when the DC Rebirth special came out and it had little hints in there that this relationship was coming back, so many people reacted positively to that it really showed what an impact that had. It was that example of erasing that relationship was kind of like, in a nutshell, summed up kind of the mistakes DC made when they changed things with the New 52. And so now that they're coming back to that relationship, reestablishing it, setting it up, it just shows the connection that these characters have and the richness that the DC universe can have and the reason that it worked and what fans loved about the DC universe. So having an issue that in a way is kind of devoted to their relationship and showing the status of it and how it's going to be going forward was great. I loved it. Surprisingly so, because, you know, I've said before, I never was the biggest Green Arrow fan going forward, and so I've been constantly surprised by the fact that every issue comes out of Green Arrow and it stays up there at the top for me as DC's best Rebirth book. And the artists they've had on the book so far, whether it be Steven Byrne or Juan Ferreira or Otto Schmidt, you know, all these guys, they're handling, you know, they're probably doing it digitally, so there's not necessarily inking to be done, or it's digitally inked over their own, you know, sketch, pencil sketch, or however you do it when you work on a digital device. And then they're coloring it themselves, and so everything is how they envision it to be and coming out the way they'd like it. And man, it is so good. There's so many beautiful scenes in this issue, the colors especially, with Oliver and Dinah on the beach at the sunset and everything. Yeah, just an absolutely gorgeous book. I hope everybody is picking up Green Arrow. If you don't read any other DC books, you should be reading Green Arrow. And one of these days, Manny is going to start reading Green Arrow. He's going to pick up with the Rebirth one-shot and read about one or two issues and go, oh my God, this is so good, and just plow through all of them. And then be sad that he's going to start reading it every 2 weeks when it comes out and get a much shorter chunk of the story. That's my prediction anyway. All right, so I know you haven't read Green Arrow 8. I didn't get a chance to read the next book we're going to talk about, which is Green Lanterns number 8, because when I picked it up and I started to read it, I realized I hadn't read 7 yet, and I couldn't find 7. So, and I've gone on record as saying I'm out on Green Lantern, so it may be that I didn't buy 7, and so then I got the digital copy of 8, and I don't know if I'll go back and get 7 or not. I guess we'll see. But the book is written by Sam Humphries. The art is by Ed Bennis, and the colors are by Blonde. So take it away, Manny. What's going on in the Green Lanterns?
Green Lantern 8, for me, was a bit cheesy. I understand that the holiday seasons are approaching, but they dive right into Halloween. So we have Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz taking out, I think that's either his cousin or his nephew.
His nephew.
His nephew trick-or-treating. And I found that to be very, very cheesy and kind of a turnoff for me going forward. But it still ties into their story. There's a guardian that has created something called the Phantom Ring, which is a ring that can be wielded by anyone. It doesn't need to be a chosen person. Anyone can wield it. There's no requisite for it, no emotion or anything. If you have it, you can put it on and use its power. So the Guardian is moving around trying to hide himself, and Simon and Jessica are looking for him try and quote unquote protect him. But they're doing it while they're trick-or-treating with. So it was a little disappointing for me, just based on how good the other issues had been. I mean, I even understood the issue before where Simon was dealing with his own emotions of trying to impress his mom, and you know, how that was going to affect him going forward with his emotional state. But this, to me, took it a little too far. So, obviously, I'm still in on Green Lanterns, but I would want to see them to go a little bit away from this. And, yeah, that's really all I got to say about it.
All right. Next up, we have Harley Quinn number 5, written by Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor. The art in this issue is handled by John Timms, and the colors are by Alex Sinclair. I don't think I've read an issue of Harley Quinn since issue 2. As I said, I pretty much am over Harley at this point, so I know you're still caught up, Manny, so what were your thoughts on Harley Quinn?
Harley Quinn 5 is the start of a new arc called Undercover Punker, where they're going to take the Harley Quinn that they've already changed and that you really liked, and they're going to change her some more. So she's going to go undercover with a couple of her friends as a punk rock band to try and find some unsavory characters that they're looking for. She's actually going to be working with the chief of police undercover, of course, because they can't be seen together or linked together. But they take a little ride in his car, and they make a deal. So her look's gonna change again. If you looked at the cover, if you've seen the cover, you know that she's gonna have a mohawk look. So I wonder how a lot of people are gonna take that. For me personally, I do not like that look. I've never liked mohawks, period. But I thought it was really cool. They have Red Tool back. They have Eggsy on drums, and they have Tony playing guitar. They even take a little trip to find Red Tool, who according to Tony is one of the baddest bass players in the land. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, Jimmy and Amanda's imagination with Harley Quinn is ridiculous, because in talking with him, and also at the Harley Quinn psychology panel, with the green light that DC has given them with Harley, he says that they have an unlimited set of stories that they want to tell with Harley, and especially because, I mean, they can take it in any direction. So you can have something as crazy as them taking out telemarketers 1 week, and now they're going undercover to take out a criminal punk rock band the next week. So that's kind of the reason why I'm in, because it's the same in a sense, which I can see why some people were turned off by that. But at the same time, just the storytelling by Jimmy and Amanda, It's funny, because they'll put in little tidbits of things going on right now. They'll take jabs at Marvel every now and then. I mean, just look at Red Tool, because I guess a lot of people had been clamoring that they should do like a Harley Quinn, a Deadpool crossover or something like that. But of course, we know that can't happen. So they created Red Tool, which you can see the similarities with them, and so far it's worked really, really well, because it's funny. I mean, it's funny how Deathstroke is a direct Deadpool was kind of a knockoff of Deathstroke, and now Deadpool has a knockoff called Red Tool. So I think that's pretty funny. So going forward, I mean, if you like Harley Quinn, you're on board. If you don't, then you dropped it already. I mean, there's you're either reading it or you're not. That's kind of how I feel. But yeah, for me, I'm reading it, so yeah, obviously I like it.
Yeah, and I decided to drop it because yeah, I was kind of Harley Quinned out. But just hearing you talk about it, I'm like, man, maybe I should be reading it. I almost actually prefer her supporting cast more than her. You know what I mean? Maybe I'm not. And again, I think a big part of it is because I did that that episode for our YouTube channel where I read, you know, all 200 plus appearances of her over a month, and it was like, man, I just got Harley Quinned out at that point. And so one of the things I really enjoyed about the book was Eggsy and Tony and Red Tool to some extent and Poison Ivy, just, you know, the supporting cast more so than her. Like seeing Tony on guitar and, you know, Red Tool on bass, which just seems cool to me, but I'm probably good on my Harley. Okay, the next book is Midnighter and Apollo Number 1. Writer Steve Orlando, his name pops up again. I told you he was busy. The art on this issue is handled by Fernando Blanco, and the colors are by Romulo Fajardo Jr. I don't really have that much to say about this issue. I enjoyed it. I'm definitely in for issue 2. I don't have a long reading history with Midnighter or Apollo. I haven't read any of their Wildstorm appearances. I hadn't read about either character before reading the New 52 Stormwatch title. And then, you know, I was a big fan of the Grayson title, and Midnighter showed up in there a lot. And in that, he's more of a villain, so I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I mean, supposedly he's a hero, but yet he has absolutely no hesitation about killing, and he even makes a reference to that in this issue. He's in bed with Apollo, and he basically says that some people just need to be killed. He certainly isn't a hero in the traditional sense, much more of an anti-hero. He would have been perfectly suited to headline a book in the 90s, and I don't know that he was created that early, but he certainly would have fit in with that time. What I found most interesting about the book is another character that I'm not familiar with, which is Mr. Bendix. He seems he's kind of the villain of the piece, and he seems to be very interesting. So I'm in because I want to learn more about who Midnighter and who Apollo is, or are, and I want to learn more about this villain, Bendix. As far as Midnighter and Apollo's relationship, I could take it or leave it. It doesn't, you know, affect me one way or the other. They're obviously gay. They're obviously, you know, together. They're a couple. They kiss, whatever. It doesn't bother me one way or the other. If one of them were female, it wouldn't, you know, I would feel the same way about it. I could take it or leave it. If it takes up pages from the story that could be, you know, action or advancing the story, then obviously I prefer not to see it. But I have no opinion on it one way or the other. So, you know, if that's the reason you're picking it up, then more power to you. For me, it doesn't affect me. I don't care, basically. So if there's going to be any kind of political statement from Steve Orlando, you know, in the book, then it'll probably, you know, go in one ear and out the other. As far as I'm concerned, it's kind of a non-issue for me. But I do find the character of Midnighter to be a little more interesting than Apollo, just because he seems to be a little more complex. He does seem to have demons. He does seem to be more flawed. And so in that way, it makes for a more interesting character and a lot of probably story there to mine. I don't know Steve Orlando's history with these characters. I would be interested to know what background he has with these two characters and what direction he's coming at the story from. But it was an enjoyable enough issue, and I'm definitely in for issue 2. The art, again, much like the issue, don't really have a whole heck of a lot to say. It's good, not great. There's a scene early on where Midnighter's fighting his way through the kind of a subway car, which was done really, really well, probably my favorite part of the issue. The panel layouts are just okay. The rendering is probably where the art is at its best. The talking head scenes are handled well enough. So yeah, all in all, a solid issue. It's not going to win any awards, but it was definitely entertaining. What do you think, Manny?
It was actually at the bottom of my digital pile to read, so I didn't get to it.
You haven't got to it? Okay. All right, up next we have Nightwing number 6, written by Steve Orlando and Tim Seeley, art by Roge Antonio, and colors by Chris Sotomayor. So this continues the Monster Men storyline. Again, Steve Orlando's event to run, I suppose you'd say. Yeah, it just continues the story from Batman number 8. And again, serviceable issue. The art, I enjoy the art in this issue a little more than the art in the Batman issue, particularly because the colors aren't quite so washed out. As far as the story goes, I think we covered it when we talked about the story in Batman number 8, you know, seeing Dick Grayson go from being a huge monster in one panel to being healed in the next, you know, how convenient, basically. And yeah, ready for this to be over. Don't care much for Hugo Strange. I've said that before. You know, apparently he's taunting Batman in a way with the way he created these monsters, which I thought was unnecessary to throw that in. Oh, you know, manipulation, fear, blah, blah, blah. You know, just like, what? I mean, can we just get to it already? So, I don't know. Not feeling it on this. Ready to move on. Ready for Nightwing to go back to its regular storyline with Raptor. I need my Raptor fix. Yeah, can't wait for Hugo Strange to go away and never be seen from or heard from again. At least not for a long, long time. He may be a bat villain that I dislike even more than the Joker. If you can believe that. I just find him to be incredibly boring. What are your thoughts, Manny?
Well, there's not much we haven't said already. Let's just move it along.
What did you think about the whole, oh, look, he's taunting Batman by manipulating these four victims that are all to do with, grief?
Fear. I thought that was overly complicated and unnecessary.
Yes.
I mean, to get to the point where we're going to be, and then in the next, in the issue number 6 of this arc, you could have done that without all the Monster Men, and that would have worked. I mean, just with the Psycho Pirate and what he had already done.
Yeah, like Dick Grayson says, people wrestling with their childhood, fighting grief, fear, and manipulating those around them, trapped by their own egos, their faults. Four patients, four monsters coming together to form something more. I know you better than anyone. The others might not see it, but I do. You said it yourself. Strange is a psychologist. These aren't just monsters. They're a statement. They're your diagnosis. Yeah, really? Can Hugo Strange... He just doesn't like Batman and he wants to fight him. I mean, he could have just put up a sign. I mean, they already know it's Strange. You know, Hugo Strange.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, let's, you know, figure out why he created these monsters and whatever. Yeah, let's move along. Let's move along, and we'll move along, and we'll talk about the next book on our list, Superman number 8, written by Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason, pencils by Doug Monkey, inks by Jaime Mendoza, and colors by Will Quintana. Another father and son story from Superman, and this time they end up on Dinosaur Island, and we get a reference to the Losers, one of the lesser-known teams in the DC Universe. And I loved it. It was really cool. You know, I just said it a little while ago. I love when DC brings out the second and third tier characters. And the fact that they're going to cross over with Superman. Heck yeah. Plus dinosaurs. Plus Doug Monkey art. Plus father and son time. Yeah. This was a great, great issue. I can't wait to read more about this story. Escape from Dinosaur Island Part 1. Is the trade dress we have on the front cover. So it looks like we're going to see a lot of the members of the Losers. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. And Superman continues to be, you know, one heck of a great book. So, yeah, hopefully we see some Captain Storm, some Sarge Peterson, some Gunner Wilson and some John Cloud. So Gunner and Sarge was they were kind of a team that showed up in some DC War comics. And then they had, you know, Captain Storm was a member of the Losers, and then Johnny Cloud was the United States Army Air Force. He was a Native American that flew fighter jets. So they came together. They formed kind of like a early Suicide Squad type. They called themselves the Losers. So very much looking forward to seeing their current version or seeing them cross over with Superman. I think it's going to be a heck of a lot of fun just because they're such different characters. You know, there's some really great classic DC war stories starring the Losers, but those were completely separate from the other universe of DC, the superhero universe. You know, that you rarely saw that, if ever, saw them cross over. So take the father and son dynamic of John and Clark Kent and throw in the Losers, throw in them trapped on an island with dinosaurs. Hey man, sounds like you have a great idea for a really great story. And the art by Doug Monkey is really, really cool. He must have been pretty stoked to be able to draw these dinosaurs. I'd be remiss if I didn't say having Crypto along with the two of them is really cool as well. Really gives it kind of that father-son, classic father-son feel. So yeah, great art. Great dialogue, great visuals. Love the panel, the page layouts, the way he draws the panels, switches it up, keeping it dynamic. Goes big with splash pages when needed. Great job on the close-ups of Crypto. Yeah, really, really enjoyable issue. Loved it. What did you think, Manny?
My favorite thing about this first issue of this arc is that it's believable. How it happened. You have Superman or Clark Kent spending time with his son working on a science project, and I think only Superman and Jonathan can work on a science project in the Fortress of Solitude and end up on Dinosaur Island. It makes sense. It just works for me. Because anybody else, I don't think it works that easily. With that being said, we saw last issue like them kind of take a break and go to the fair, and so now we start this issue off with them working on a science project, and oops, they screw up. Crypto kind of gets involved, and here we are. We ended up on Dinosaur Island, and you're going to end up with some losers too. So. It's gonna be a fun couple of issues. It's weird too because I mean, for some people, you see what had happened on Action Comics with Doomsday, and then so the action is it's a little different than maybe what you expected. Also, you had all the action that you had in Superman Last Days and things like that, and now you're more focused on his relationship with Jonathan. And so it makes for a different look at Superman that maybe we haven't seen in a while or at all. So it's such a great book. Lots of father-son moments. I mean, it just kind of shows you the diverse titles that DC is putting out right now, because I mean there's something for everyone. And This Superman book is a clear indication of that, and I mean if it weren't enough that they're telling such a great story with Superman and Jonathan, now you add Crypto, and it just adds another kind of like the cherry on top, because a lot of people love Crypto, so it's nice to see him involved and in the book with them. And also the artwork is fantastic. I thought a lot of Crypto's expressions I thought were really done really well, and not to mention Superman himself looks really good in a lot of these pages. So very excited to get the next issue, and I like this direction that they took with Superman. I've seen some people complain about it. But I love it.
You've seen some people complain about what?
About Superman and Jonathan, about a lot of the books being like father and son. You know, they want the Superman versus Lex Luthor kind of stories, or Superman versus Brainiac, or things like that. But
and those have been done. This is something new.
Exactly. That's what the internet.
Yeah, I mean, how many times have you told me that you don't care for Superman as a character? You like him more now than you ever have. Am I right or wrong?
Completely, yes.
Yeah, and it's because of telling these kind of stories, making him relatable, making him a father, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter what kind of superpowers you have. If you're a father, you're going to be dealing with the same problems that you and I deal with as fathers.
That's right.
So it makes Superman relatable to every one of us, because you and I are also going to have to deal with our kids and their science projects, or even taking a day off from our very busy schedules to take our family to the fair or something like that. Those are things that are relatable even with Superman. So, I mean, what else do you want?
Yeah, I'll go on record right now. If I'm working on a science project with Aspen and we disappear, can you look for us on the nearest dinosaur island?
Okay.
All right, fair enough. All right, Manny, so what do you got for your book of the week?
You know what? This one's a little bit of a tough one. I have three books that I think that are deserving for my book of the week, but I'm going to go with Superman.
That was Superman. I gave some considerations. I couldn't decide, to be honest with you, so I'm going to go with co-books of the week, but then...
That's cheating. You got to pick one.
For second place, I would have to. So, you're going to make me nerd. Well, let me just say, cause the four that I were like, man, I really can't decide between. So, Dead Man and Hawkman were the two that really were like my favorite two of the week. And then Midnighter and Apollo, just because I'm so curious to learn more about them. And then Superman. But maybe I'd put Superman just, you know, a hair above Midnighter and Apollo. But, man, if you asked me to pick between Hawkman and Dead Man, oh, man, that's really, really tough. Okay, if I have to pick one, I'm going to go with Dead Man, just because it's a longer story. There's more, you know, it's like a double-sized, so there's more to the story. There's like two chapters where I only get one chapter in the Hawkman book. It's a terrible reason to pick, because once I read the second issue of Hawkman, then it could be that I enjoy those first two chapters more than the first two chapters of Dead Man. But that's not the case. You know, I only have one chapter versus kind of a double size from Dead Man. So for that reason, I'll pick Dead Man.
Yeah, for me, it was between Superman, Cyborg, and Dead Man.
Oh, I forgot about Cyborg.
Hawkman, it was up there, but I thought maybe if they would have kept the other name, it would have been considered. But Dead Man had really great art, and it was just really cool to see Dead Man. Cyborg was just written so well, and then Superman all around it was really, really good. So
yeah,
but I have to give it to Superman.
I mean, when I look at books like Cyborg and Green Arrow, I mean, they're so good. Every issue of Cyborg has been outstanding. Every issue of Green Arrow has been outstanding. It's just like Wonder Woman. It's like every week when those books come out, I could just pick them as my favorite. You know what I mean? Because they've consistently been absolutely amazing every time. And so, in a way, it's almost unfair. I mean, I don't want to pick them every time because then I'm not being diverse with my picks, and I'm not like spreading the love. But at the same time, it's not fair to not pick them because they are so good. You know what I mean? It's like the curse of being too good. It's so good. Cyborg has been so good. Green Arrow has been so good that when you look at one particular issue, maybe it doesn't stand out as much from the pack as it normally would because it's at this high level already. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, if every issue is like a 99 out of 100, then when you look at it on a graph, it would be a flat line. You know what I mean? Where you don't have issues that stand out because they're all, you know, at that high level. So, yeah, I mean, I've been singing the praises of Cyborg and Green Arrow for a long time now. So, yeah, those, of course, are great books as well. But, yeah, I'm going to stick with Dead Man, especially because I don't know that I haven't heard a lot of people talking about it. So I think it's good to show some love to some books that aren't going to have as many eyes on them or not as well known. I mean, automatically, a DC book that's coming out right now that doesn't have the Rebirth trade dress on it is probably not getting as much attention as the books that do. So, but yeah, I can't fault your pick, man. That Superman book was really great. I'd probably pick the next one if it actually has the losers in it rather than just their names and some of their remains.
No, but I mean, the week to week, like you're saying, you can pick almost any book and justify it to be your book of the week. So yeah.
DC's really killing it right now. It's a good problem to have.
Oh, yeah.
All right, everybody. That's going to do it for this episode of The Comic Source. Thanks for joining us. You can go to our website, thecomicsourceblog.com, for all past episodes of our podcast. You can also find episodes of our YouTube channel there. You can also find links to our written blogs, both Manny's and mine. You can check out our famous sketch gallery. We do have some recent sketches we haven't added that we should be adding soon. Follow along on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource, or on Facebook and Instagram. Those are the best places to keep up to date with what's going on as far as conventions we're attending, creators we're interviewing, all the cosplay that we're seeing at these conventions, as well as finding out when we release new episodes. We've pretty much gone to a daily release schedule these days, Monday through Friday, and then once in a while we'll throw things up on the weekend. So there's one more interview from Long Beach Comic Con with Joelle Jones to be released, and we also have a spotlight on Aftershock Comics that I did that's going to be coming up, probably released the same day as this this episode. I basically took every Aftershock comic that has been published as of this last weekend and sat down and reread them all. I'm going to go through and talk about each series individually, talk a little bit about their creators, talk about what I thought of the series, the art, and they're putting out a lot of really, really great books. I really can't recommend them enough. I feel like a lot of these books are flying under the radar, maybe with the exception of Animosity. But that's a perfect example why you should go and seek these books out. Part of the reason Animosity is so hard to get your hands on is because not a lot of people knew about it. Not a lot of people were paying attention. So for that reason, hardly anybody asked for it. The initial order numbers were low from retailers. So then it hit and it got a lot of positive publicity and a lot of people were saying how good it was. And a lot of comic fans ran out to their comic shop to try to buy it, and it just wasn't there because the print run was so low because people hadn't ordered it. They hadn't told their retailers that they were looking for it. So there's a lot of really good comics, a lot of really good series coming out from Aftershock. And you do yourself a favor, go to their website, aftershockcomics.com, and read up on the books. Find out what you might be interested in. Let your retailer know, so you can go and ask for them, you know, so that you won't miss out. You don't want another situation like with Animosity number one, where you are unable to pick up the books. And if you're going to be at New York Comic Con this weekend, I'm very jealous of you. Aftershock is based out of New York, and they're going to have a booth there with a lot of convention exclusives. The Dreaming Eagles variant hardcover edition, if you buy one of those there at the booth, you can get it signed by Garth Ennis. A lot of the other creators are going to be there. Adam Glass, Amanda Connor, Brian Azzarello, Jimmy Palmiotti, Joe Pruitt, Juan Doe, Marguerite Bennett, Tim Seeley, Justin Jordan. Just the list goes on and on. Go check it out. They're going to have a lot of their comics there, collected editions. They'll have some of their books that are graded, both regular and signed. Collectible pins, t-shirts, stickers, like all kinds of great stuff. Go over, say hi, tell them you heard about Aftershock Comics on the Comic Source podcast, and they should take really good care of you. So if you're interested in learning more about Aftershock Comics, listen to that Spotlight episode. It's got a lot of great information. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.